waited, leaning his weight impatiently against the homemade door. In a minute the latch clicked, and Ole, still in his orange-banded sweater, backed away to let him come in. The minute he looked at the Swede's face, a slow, climbing rage tightened in Bo's stomach and chest. Ole's face was drawn and sick, his eyes glittering like blue ice, his mouth chapped and stained in the corners. "What's the matter?" Bo said sharply. "You sick?"
"It don't feel good," Ole said. "It ain't felt good for a couple days."
"Well, for Christ's sake, why didn't you come into Chinook with me yesterday?" Ole didn't answer, and Bo stood with his hands spread over the stove, watching the drawn face. He was sick, all right. He was sick as a horse. His hands shook, and when he stooped to sit down in the bunk, he had to reach back and ease himself down. "So now," Bo said, "I suppose I've got this big ox on my hands, with the Ford already so loaded she hits bottom on every bump." "You're a damn fool to stay out here alone in the first place," he said. Ole shook with a heavy chill, grabbed his hands together and held them to still their trembling, but said nothing. "Got any coffee?" Ole's eyes lifted to the stove. Bo took the top off the pot, saw that there was a good pint of black liquid inside, and shoved it onto the hot part of the stove. While they waited for it to boil, he went out and got a bottle of bourbon. "Where's your corkscrew?" he said.
"He ain't got one."
"Oh, for—" Angrily, Bo pawed through the half-dozen knives and forks and spoons on the cupboard shelf. Nothing, not even a paring knife. He tipped the bottleneck down and gave the bottom a stiff, flat-palmed smack, hitting it so hard that pain jolted up his wrist. You had to hit it just right to jar the cork loose, and it was a damn fool stunt anyway. He had seen a man cut his hand half off trying it, but if this big dumb Ole didn't have a corkscrew, there was nothing else to do. He jolted the bottle again, savagely. On the fifth try, he caught it right. The cork started a quarter of an inch, and he got the blade of his knife under it and lifted carefully till it came out. He poured a tin cup, a third full, and handed it to Ole. "This is supposed to be medicine," he said. "See what it does for you." He had a swig himself out of the bottle, corked it, and stuck it in the pocket of his coat. The coffee pot was steaming, rocking a little on the stove. "Got a cup or anything you haven't used lately?" Bo said. Ole's mouth opened helplessly. He wrinkled his forehead, looking at the cupboard. "Well, what the hell?" Bo said. He found a saucepan and poured coffee into it for himself, filled the Swede's cup. "Drink that damn quick," he said. "We gotta get out of here." His own coffee was black and bitter, with grounds floating in it, but he drank it in gulps, scalding hot. In 10 minutes he had the bundled Swede outside with a quilt around him. The two cases of whiskey in the front seat had to be shifted to the back. That was bad, because they were loose and might bounce and break, but there was nothing else he could do. He boosted Ole inside and tucked the quilt in, went inside to snatch 2 blankets off the bunk, dumped the coffee pot into the fire and kicked the draft shut and closed the door. There was a definite wind now, a creeping, close-to-the-ground wind that he could feel as a steady pressure from the northwest. The drifting didn't seem to be much worse. The snow was packed, and only the top dust blew. But it was cold. It was cold as all billy hell. And if it hadn't been for this jinx Swede, he'd be almost a Gadkey's by now. As he climbed in, he looked with distaste at Ole's muffled face. A guy that big ought to be all man. Ole was definitely a jinx. At the first coulee head, still within sight of his shack, they had to run through a shallow swale drifted a foot deep on one side. Bo took it charging, but something under the snow, burnout or badger hole, rocked them with a solid, bouncing shock, and the Ford hit bottom and died in the drift. The inside filled with the smell of whiskey. "God damn," Bo said. He yanked the side curtain loose, ripping one of the eyelets, and swarmed over the side. God knew how many bottles were busted. There wasn't even time to look now. That wind was too dangerous. Hard pebbles stung his face, and he looked up to see that they were not drift, but snow. Shoveling like a dynamo, he cleared the wheels and threw the shovel inside. "Can you drive?" he said to Ole. Ole shook his head. "You're going to anyway," Bo said. "Shove over here." He showed Ole how to let the brake off and push down on the low pedal, feeding gas at the same time. "When I say go, let her have it," he said. He braced himself against the body, said, "Go!" and heaved forward. The Swede jammed on the pedal, forgot to feed gas, and killed the engine. "Gas!" Bo yelled. "Give it gas!" Ole dropped his hands from the wheel and leaned away. His face was pitiful, as if he were going to cry. Bo took a deep breath and swallowed his rage, cranked, braced himself again. "Now take it easy," he said. "When I say go, let her in slow and give her plenty of gas." This time the Swede gave her too much and went roaring and spinning up the coulee side, out of control, scared to death, and with his foot frozen to the gear pedal, so that Bo, encumbered with his heavy coat, had to sprint alongside and jump on the running board to yank on the handbrake. He was breathing hard when he climbed in, and his mind was red hot. The air inside the curtains was so thick with spilled whiskey, it was almost intoxicating. By the time they reached Gadke's, the tracks were drifted half full, only the top edges clear, and the gray sky was spitting snow as hard as hail against the windshield. The wind increased steadily, pushing against the bellied side curtains, pouring in the V-shaped hole where Bo had torn the eyelet. And it was getting colder. He could feel it getting colder by the quarter hour. Feel it in his bones and in his mind. This was going to be a regular old he-blizzard, and he was still 40 miles from home. At the horse pasture gate, he stopped long enough to fit the radiator blanket on, thanking his stars that he had had sense enough to make it. There was no worrying about the trail now. The best he could do was to follow his yesterday's tracks, hoping to God they held out. His jaw clenched on him automatically as he drove, and at intervals he sat back and loosened it. Then the tense concentration of trying to see ahead through the drift and the murky white darkness crept into his muscles again until he came to and forcibly relaxed once more. Ole sat beside him, humped in the quilt. They passed through the horse pasture faster than Bo had been able to go coming out. The not-quite-covered tracks did that for them at least. But at the far gate of the pasture, Bo stood outside the ford, his eyes slitted against the drift, and wondered whether to stay with the tracks, off the road, or try to pick up the trail. He hadn't been far off that time. If he started straight out from the gate, he ought to hit his tracks again within a half mile. It was taking chances, but there wasn't much time. The wind by now was a positive force, a thing you fought against. Drift and falling snow were indistinguishable. The air was thick with stinging pebbles, the visibility hardly 50 feet. It was so cold that his eyes stung and watered, his nose leaked. When he wiped it with the back of his mitt, he felt the slick ice on the leather. He piled in beside the Swede. "How do you feel?" he said. "Okay?" Ole nodded, and they started again. Bo was driving partly by sight, partly by feel now. The wind was from the northwest. He wanted to go almost exactly northeast. If he kept the wind square against the left side curtains, kept them stiff and strained as a sail, he couldn't go far wrong. The minute they flapped or slackened, he was circling. Either that or the wind was shifting. But you didn't think about that. Ahead of him was a whirling blur of light, the whole world driving, moving, blowing under his wheels. It was like driving on fast water, except when bumps or holes or burnouts bounced them clear down to the axle. Bo squinted, peering, his stiff hands clenched on the wheel. There were almost effaced tracks ahead. He'd hit it right on the nose. But the tracks turned off left, and the slack in the side curtains, when he started to follow them, stopped him. He had almost followed his own tracks the wrong way. That would have been a nice one. He backed and started in the other direction. He knew he was off the road. The feel of the tires told him that. But as long as he kept the wind there, he'd eventually run into the graded road paralleling the south bench. He'd get her in, by the gods, if he had to drive the last 20 miles by ear. The tires hit the road again. He could feel it, smooth and hard and sunken, though his eyes showed him no difference. Within 5 minutes, the ruts were gone. He swung into the wind, feeling for them like a blind man, his body tense, one with the body of the car. And in the moment when he turned, feeling, the wind burst furiously against the side curtain and tore it loose, and he was blinded and muffled in cloth and icy isinglass. Cursing, he stepped on the pedals and fought the frantic, flapping thing out of his face. The eyelets were all ripped now, and there was no fastening it down. Wind and snow drove into the hole, hammering his eyes shut, peppering his face. His fury ripped out of him in shouted swearing as he twisted, trying to fasten the curtain somehow. The Swede was a hindrance to his movements, and he shoved him over in the seat with one fierce hunch of the shoulder. Eventually he had to grope in the back seat and find one of Ole's blankets, poke it up over the metal bar along the top, pull it down through, and sit on both ends. It wasn't as good as the curtain, and it made the car almost as dark as night, but it kept that paralyzing wind out of his face while he drove. The thing became a nightmare. He sat within the dark cabin of the car, his numb feet ready to jump on the pedals, his mitt slipping up and down the smooth wheel to feed or retard gas, his eyes glued on the flowing, dirty gray-white world ahead. In an hour he was on and off the road a dozen times. The strain and cold stiffened his legs and arms, but the excitement got into him, too. He turned to look at Ole, only his long nose and white eyebrows showing above the quilt, and in the steady motor-sounding and wind-sounding and snow-pebble-sounding silence of the car, he opened his mouth and yelled. "Yippee!" he yelled. "Powder River Letterbuck!" The Swede jumped 6 inches, and his lugubrious, startled face turned.
"You think we make it?" he said.
Bo laughed, jamming the Ford recklessly through a drift. "You're goddamn right, eh, tink we make it," he said. He leaned back, stretching, relaxing his tightened muscles for the 20th time. The whirl of snow, visible through the windshield, lifted briefly, showing him a drift deeper than most, long and crested and fringed with blowing tatters of snow. He stepped on the low pedal and dragged down the gas, and then when they were halfway through the drift, slugging through it like a boat through a wave, he saw the fence dead ahead. His hands yanked the wheel around, and his feet stabbed at brake and reverse at the same time. The Ford shuddered, swung, skidded, caught, hit something big and solid under the drift, and very slowly, as if careful not to hurt or break anything, turned over on its side. The Swede's 200 pounds came down on Bo, smashing him against the blanket curtain. He felt the snow under the blanket crush and give, heard bottles smash, and then he was fighting back against Ole's dead weight, reaching out through the clumsy coat and mitts and blanket to turn the switch and cut the motor, still running on its side. "Get off!" he roared. "Get your damn dead carcass out of here!" Chapter 3 Elsa saw the storm coming by mid-morning. At noon, when she was certain it was going to be bad, she sent the boys out after buckets of lignite, and herself went out to the barn, broke open 2 bales of hay with the pliers, and tumbled the packed, dusty slabs down into the mangers. If the winds blew hard for very long, she might not be able to get out for a while. The wind was up strong when she closed the barn doors. She had to wrestle them with all her weight. Worry about Bo drove her to sit by the kitchen window afterward, staring across the vacant lot toward the south road. The air was striated and thick with driving snow. Sometimes such a gust drove in from the river bend that Van Dam's house and shed and the low windmill tower were blotted out, and only the madly whirling blades remained in sight. Jim Van Dam ought to do something about that mill. It would blow to pieces if he didn't. She was about to call Chet and send him over to tell them their mill was up, but another look at the wind and snow outside made her hesitate, and the boys should be kept in because of the flu. She reached for her coat, stooping to see if the blades were still there. "I'm going over to Van Damme's," she called into the other room. "You stay in the house, both of you." Her eyes screwed shut, body doubled against the gusts. She made her way across the lot and up to the Van Damme's kitchen door. Her knock went rattling down the wind. No one could possibly have heard it. She pushed on the knob, and the wind blew her into the kitchen. Jim Van Damme, a lumpy quilt around him, was sitting on the oven door with a dishpan between his feet. He did not look up, but his wife, holding his forehead, turned a white face and made a sick grimace with her mouth. Then he gagged and retched, and she clung to him, holding him upright.
"He just took sick this morning," Mrs. Van Damme said. "He was all right till after breakfast, and then he said he felt queer, and I gave him some calomel, and he's been throwing up for a half hour."
She didn't say, "Now he's got it," but she might just as well have. Elsa took off her coat.
"Where's little Jimmy?" she said.
"Upstairs. I wouldn't let him come down too close."
"Haven't you got a couch in the parlor?"
"Yes."
"We ought to get him to bed," Elsa said.
She looked at Jim Van Damme, contracted in a heavy chill. But when she stooped to help Mrs. Van Damme get him to his feet and lead him into the couch, the other woman's eyes met hers.
"Oh, Lord," Mrs. Van Damme said. "Now you've got close to him."
"I'd have got close one way or another," Elsa said. "None of us can hide away, I guess."
She stayed until the sick man was in bed. Then she brought in a good supply of coal and kindling and two buckets of water from the well. The windmill, she saw, was already ruined, its whole broad tail gone. But it was no time to be worrying about windmills. When she sat inside again, having a cup of coffee with Mrs. Van Damme, she tried not to see the tears that dropped on the oilcloth or the scrawny thinness of Mrs. Van Damme's arms. But even more than that, she tried not to see the picture that her mind kept trying to uncover, a picture of Beau fighting his way back through this blizzard, maybe sick himself. If Jim Van Damme was all right at breakfast and was this sick by noon, Beau could have had the same thing happen.
"I'll go call up Dr. O'Malley," she said. "He'll probably want to send a rig to take Jim to the schoolhouse. They've got the school teachers nursing, and he'd get better care there."
"Thank you," Mrs. Van Damme said. "I guess that'd be better. I'm no good. When I knew he had it, I just went all to pieces.
"Don't worry," Elsa said. "Give him a hot lemonade and some salts when he can hold them down, and I'll see if I can't get somebody. They may not be able to get around till tomorrow if this keeps up, but I'll run over and see if you need anything."
It was not until the odd jobs, the telephoning, the grim preparatory look through the medicine cupboard, were all done, that worry crept up on her and stayed. It came obliquely, discreetly, while the wind leaned its weight against the house, howled around the eaves, strained the frame until the walls creaked. No car could get a mile in such weather. She had confidence in Beau. He could get through if anyone could. But that was just the trouble. He might very well have started from Chinook while there was only that pre-storm haze, that ominous, coppery blurring over the sun, thinking that he could run through before it broke. And once it broke, he wouldn't stop. He'd butt right on ahead, stubborn as a mule, no matter how cold it got or how the wind blew. She went to the front window and looked at the thermometer hung on the outside frame. 2 below. An hour ago it had been 5 above, at noon 10 above. The longer he drove, if he was driving, the worse it got. Her nervousness wouldn't let her sit still. She went to the sewing machine and got out the dress she was making for Frida Appleton, who was getting married next month. One way to keep from worrying was to stitch buttonholes. But every few minutes during the 2 hours she sat sewing, she kept getting up to stoke the stove, shake down ashes, walk to the window and see the temperature down to 4 below, to 5, to 8. The boys squabbled over the erector set on the dining room table, and she separated them and punished Chet with only half her mind on what she was doing. If Beau had started after breakfast, he ought to be in now. The clock said 4:45. Still, he hadn't promised to be home tonight. He would certainly have stopped along the road at Cree or Gadkey's, or maybe at Robsart if he had chosen that road. He was probably sitting by some fire not 2 hours away from home, waiting for the storm to blow out. But suppose the snow blocked the roads and stayed? There would be no moving the car till spring. "Oh, fiddle," she said. "He can take care of himself. He could get a bobsleigh or something." "With all that liquor aboard?" her mind said. "What would he do with that? Suppose he stopped somewhere and they called in the police?" She spun it back and forth, stitching steadily at the monotonous buttonholes that went from neck to waist down the back of the dress. The stove glowed dull red in the corner, but over where she sat under the lamp, needing light now to see, it was cold. Occasionally a tension stiffened her body as she thought she heard noises that were not the wind. Once she was sure she heard a car, but the window showed nothing, and when she tried to look out the back door, it was nailed fast by the wind. For a minute she stood listening. The sound did not come again. Before she quite gave it up, she went out on the front porch, half blocked by an angled drift laid in on the side swipe of wind, and stood for a minute with the snow buzzing in the air around her, settling on hair and dress. He wouldn't try to come through today. There was no use worrying. Besides, it was time to get the boys' supper. Shut in, they did nothing but eat. They had been piecing all day, and still they said periodically, every 10 minutes, "Ma, when do we eat?" Still, she went back to the buttonholes for a few more minutes, unwilling just yet to break her listening. But what if, her mind said slyly, Beau stopped somewhere along the road and they had the flu there? Or what if he got so sick on the road he couldn't make it to shelter? For one catastrophic instant, she saw the image of cattle frozen by the roadsides in the spring, still frozen but bloated, horrible, obscene, as the spring thaws softened them for the final decay, and she gritted her teeth and stood up. It was then that she heard the unmistakable thumping on the porch. When she opened the door, a short, involuntary cry was wrenched out of her. A man was stretched out on the steps, feet trailing in the broken snow, and another man was pulling at his shoulders, trying to drag him. He turned his head at her cry, and his grim face, only nose and eyes showing from the fur cap, brought her flying out to help him. Together they dragged the heavy figure of the other man into the hallway. The boys were in the door. "Get out of the way," Beau said harshly, and shouldered through them. They laid the man down, and in the light from the front room Elsa recognized Ole Peterson. His cheeks and nose were leprous white, and he had evidently been crying because his eyelids were stuck fast with ice. Her eyes darted to Beau. "Oh, I was afraid," she said. "Where?" She was noticing 20 things at once. The rattling icicles beaten into the hair of the dogskin coat, the monstrous hulk of Beau's shoulders, the harsh jut of brows and nose from the fur cap, the way he stood with feet wide apart, swaying, the telltale white patches on cheeks and nose. In one quick glance, while she moved to shut the door on the curving lee-side wind, she saw all those things, and her hands and feet and voice leaped into action all at once. "Lie down on the couch," she said to Beau. "Chet, get a dishpan full of snow. Bruce, run upstairs and get some blankets and quilts, anything." Reaching outside, she scooped a handful of snow and slammed the door. The boys were still stupidly staring at Ole's corpse-like body. Beau stood in the hall door, swaying a little and grinning at her. She hustled the boys off, slapped the handful of snow into his face, and held it there. He stood for it quietly, and when the last white patch had disappeared, wiped his face clumsily on a towel, his hands still cased in the icy mitts. He was stooping to look at Ole when Elsa got the pan of snow from Chet and came up. He motioned her away. "Stay away from him, all of you," he said. Deliberately, as if contemptuous of his own Samaritanism, he smeared snow in Ole's face with a mittened hand, found it clumsy, and held out his hands to Elsa. "Pull these off," he said. The leather was frozen stiff, curved from the wheel, and the mitts came off hard. When they came, Elsa cried out again. Beau's fingers were white, clear to the second joint. She tried to push them down in the pan of snow, but he snarled at her and brushed her away. She watched helplessly while his frozen fingers rubbed snow on the frozen cheeks and nose and chin of the Swede. In a minute she had started forward to pull at him.
"Let me," she said, "if he has to be fixed first."
"Get back," he said. He waved at the boys crowding on the stairway to look down. "You two, get away on back."
"What's the matter with him?" she said. "Is he hurt?"
Beau didn't answer. He tried to take off Ole's mittens, could not grip them with his own wooden hands, and ended by pulling them off with his teeth. Ole's hands were all right. On his heels beside the Swede, Beau squatted and washed his hands in the pan.
"I don't know what to do about this big sucker," he said, finally. "I don't want you tending him. He's got the flu, I guess."
"Chester," Elsa said without turning her head, "call up Dr. O'Malley and tell him if he's going to pick up Jim Van Damme as soon as the storm stops, he'd better pick up Ole here, too."
"Van Damme got it," Beau said. "I was over there helping this afternoon."
Their eyes met, and Beau shrugged.
"Then I guess there's no use taking care. I didn't want to bring him home, but there wasn't anything else I could do with the guy."
"Brucey," Elsa said, "you start taking off Pa's moccasins. Chet, soon as you telephone, get a new pan of snow and a bucket of water." Leaving Ole on the floor under a quilt, she led Beau into the couch. He walked awkwardly, his face fiery red now, and his hair on end. Coming out of the bearish bulkiness of the coat, his head and neck had a curiously frail, human look that made Elsa shake her head. "You got used to thinking of Beau as capable of anything, but this drive must have been close." She steered her mind away from how close it must have been. His hands and face frozen, maybe his feet.
"Hurry," she said to Bruce. "Hustle!"
Her own hands were busy kneading his fingers in the pan of snow, working them, stripping them like the teats of a cow, rubbing down the wrists.
"Feel anything?"
He shook his head. "Let's get a little closer to the fire," he said.
He started to rise, but she pushed him back.
"You stay away from the fire."
She rubbed at the cold, curved, inhuman fingers, and relief brought tears to her eyes.
"Oh, Beau," she said, "you shouldn't have tried to come through."
Bruce was pulling with both hands at the heavy socks, their tops stiff frozen. One came off, and Elsa, looking down, winced. The feet, too, waxen and ribbed by the ribs of the socks, like something hardened in a mold. She looked at Beau's red, unshaven face, and he winked at her, drawing down the corners of his mouth.
"Too many patients for you, Mama," he said.
Elsa dumped snow in Chet's pail of water, rolled up Beau's trouser legs, and set both feet in the pail. The water slopped over, but she went on working, shifting from fingers to toes.
"Feel anything yet?"
"Hands a little. I haven't felt my feet since we tipped over." That brought her head up.
"Tipped over? How did you get in, then?"
"I drove in,"
Beau said. His mood seemed to have changed suddenly. He looked and sounded savage, as if the very memory made him mad.
"But," she said, still rubbing, "if you tipped over—"
"I tipped it back up," he said harshly. "Don't ask me how. I don't know how. I don't know how I got in, either, so you needn't ask me that. I didn't know I was here till I ran into the fence."
"Oh, my Lord," Elsa said softly. "You're lucky."
He grunted irritably.
"Yeah, I'm lucky. I ran into that big dumb Ole and had to bring him in. I'm lucky I froze my face and hands and feet. I'm lucky I broke God knows how many bottles of hooch. I'm lucky as hell, all right."
She kept still, and later, when the pain came like fire into his hands and feet, and he roared at her to let him alone, she did as he asked. There was nothing she knew about the care of frostbite except to keep it from thawing out too fast, to prevent gangrene. Maybe he'd get gangrene anyway. It had taken a long time to get the blood back into his feet. "And all," she said in one spiteful instant, "for a load of whiskey and a few dollars." Because Bo was in too much pain now to put his weight on his feet, she got the boys to help knock one of the upstairs beds apart and set it up again in the dining room. Ole Peterson came out of his stupor and moaned, and she tugged and dragged and rolled him onto the couch in the parlor. Then she fed the boys and sent them off to bed. Curiously, that night was one of almost blissful peace. Her worry was gone. Bo was home and safe. The blizzard whined and howled and pounded around the house, and the thermometer on the porch dropped steadily until at 10 o'clock it hovered around 20 below. But the parlor stove was brick red. There was a comfortable, lazy smell of baking paint from the asbestos mat in the corner. She sat on the edge of the bed in the dining room and talked to Bo quietly, remembering the other time she had had to rub his frosted face with snow, the day she and Bo had decided to be married. Ole Peterson in the other room drank the duck soup she fixed for him and sank into a light, mumbling sleep, and with the lamp blown out, she and Bo talked. He told her about Chinook and the fear that was chasing everybody inside to hibernate. "A lot of people wouldn't have brought Ole in," she said, and smoothed the hair back from his forehead. Bo grunted. "All this running away. If it's going to get you, it's going to get you."
"Funny," Elsa said. "Once it comes right into your own house, you're not scared anymore. It's just like any sickness, and it doesn't paralyze you the way it did at first."
"If you're not scared, you're the only person in Saskatchewan that isn't." He reached out to pull her down for a kiss and flinched back. She felt the jerk of his body, and a slow, warm, tender amusement filled her. He could overcome almost anything, do almost anything. But give him a little pain and put him in bed, and he was the biggest baby on earth. A woman could stand twice as much. It was like the way the flu seemed to take the biggest and strongest men, as if their very strength was their weakness. She moved, and Bo hissed at her through gritted teeth to go easy. When she dragged the covers over his feet that way, she liked to kill him.
"What will you do about the things in the car?" she said. "You can't walk, and you can't hold anything in your hands."
"I don't know, unless maybe you and the kids can get it in. None of it's very heavy but the keg, and that'll roll."
"We'll get it," she said. "Are you sure it's all right out there tonight? Won't it freeze or something?"
He roared with laughter that clicked off against his teeth when the pain hit him. "Old mama," he said, "it'll freeze about as quick as the thermometer will."
"How about the car radiator?"
"Have to get a new one," he said. "That'll be froze solid before now. I wasn't in very good shape to drain her when I pulled in."
"No,"
she said, and stooped carefully to kiss his raw, hot face.
"You couldn't have gone on much longer, could you?"
"It was pretty touchy for a while."
She said, quiet now, at rest, warm and peaceful, and in possession of her husband and her home, and not afraid of anything because somehow they'd pull through it. They always did.
She lay down beside him, and he turned to nuzzle her in her throat. His lips nipped softly at the skin under her jaw. "Take off your clothes," he whispered.
"How about Ole?"
"He's dead to the world."
"Don't talk that way. He might really be."
"He's all right. Take them off."
"But your hands," she said. "Your feet."
"I don't need any hands or feet."
"Well," she said, softly laughing, "if you want to hurt yourself..."
"I want to hurt you, too," he said, and bit her suddenly in the side of the neck. "I want us both to lie here and love and hurt together. And then I want to sleep for 24 hours. But in the morning the peace was gone, along with the violence of the wind. When she slid out of bed, Bo still slept, one swollen hand up to his cheek. His breath was quick and noisy. She started to feel his forehead, but didn't for fear of waking him. In the other room, Ole Peterson was blazing with fever, his voice so weak that she could hardly make out what he said. Blood had oozed in tiny droplets through the pores of his cheeks and nose, and the inert helplessness of his body alarmed her. In slippers and robe, she padded into the kitchen to make up the fire and get some breakfast going. The rattling of the stove when she shook down the ashes woke Beau. "He felt hot," he said, "and his eternally goddamned hands and feet were killing him. His back felt as if a log had dropped across it, and his bones ached. For a while she went on trying to believe that his fever was from the frostbite and the terrible trip, but after breakfast he gurgled frantically, waved his arm, grew purple. She ran with a pan, and he leaned out of bed to vomit, every joint tortured with retching, his eyes shut and the sweat standing out on his forehead in great drops. She remembered Jim Van Damme yesterday, the big man helpless as a stunned calf, and she couldn't pretend any more. The sleigh from the livery stable came just after she and Chet had finished getting the liquor in from the Ford. The house stank with the smell from the 7 broken bottles when Lars Poulsen knocked on the door and said to get the patients ready, he'd go get Van Damme and be back. He stood on the porch and chewed tobacco rhythmically, watching her from under his felt cap.
"See, your car got left out."
"Yes."
"Bow out driving when the wind come on?"
She hesitated a moment.
"Yes."
"Where's he now?" Poulsen said. "Like to see him a minute."
"Come in," she said. "He's sick. I was just going to ask you to take him into the schoolhouse."
Poulsen came in, stood at Beau's bedside.
"Fella told me you had some hooch for sale," he said.
"Who told you that?"
"I don't know. One of the guys."
He lifted his head and sniffed.
"Smells like he had it about right."
"What do you want?" Beau said. "I'm sort of laid out. Sis'll get it for you."
"How much is it?" Elsa said. "I don't know anything about it."
"I can tell you, can't I?"
he said. "Get a pencil and I'll make you a price list. You'll have to run this thing if I'm getting lugged off to the hospital." She got paper and pencil and made a list at his dictation and sold Lars Poulsen a 1/2 gallon of rye and watched him tuck it carefully under the seat of the bobsleigh and turn his horses toward Van Damme's. It was almost funny the way her dislike for the whiskey business boomeranged. She was the operator of a blind pig now, all by herself. She could be arrested if anyone wanted to turn her in. But there was no time now to worry about that. Poulsen was a long time at Van Damme's. When everything was ready for him, she sat on the bed.
"I hate to see you go up there," she said. "I'd rather take care of you here, but I think for the kid's sake—"
"You'd be up all night," Beau said. "You stay home and take it easy, and I'll be back in a few days. This isn't anything but grip."
"It's worse than grip. You be careful and do what they tell you to up there. I can imagine you ranting around and refusing to take your medicine."
He grunted. "Some of that hooch ought to be delivered," he said. "The Sawbones gets the case of Irish, and there's a list of guys who get bourbon in my pocket somewhere."
She found the list.
"I'll see that they get it."
"Chet could take it on his sled," he said. "But tell him not to leave it without the money. Not for anybody."
"I won't be sending Chet," she said. "I won't have the kids mixed up in this."
For a minute he looked at her, red-faced and puffy-lipped. Then he grunted. But he was tender with her when Poulsen's knock sounded.
"Take it easy," he whispered. "I got a hunch that as soon as we get past this flu, we're out of the woods."
Her lip was trembling, and she bit it down.
"Beau, get well right away. Do what they tell you, and don't get mad at anything."
"What would I get mad at?"
"You always get mad when you're sick. You get mad at people for trying to help."
"Oh, bull,"
he said, grinning. To Poulsen, he said,
"How are you going to get me out there? Got another man?"
"Nope. Can't you walk a few steps? I'll hold you up."
"My feet are froze,"
Beau said, instantly irritable.
"Walking out there would be like walking on broken glass. Why the hell can't they send 2 men on a job like this?"
"Ain't got 'em to send," Poulsen said. "How about riding on my back? How much you weigh?"
210,
Beau said. He snorted, a short, violent sound.
"Feel like lugging 210 out there?"
"Now come on," Elsa said. "I can take your feet if Lars will take your shoulders."
They got him out finally, and he lay in the hay of the wagon box with his forehead white and dewed, his jaw tight and his eyes furious. Then Ole, almost as heavy, but easier to carry because they didn't have to be careful of hands and feet. Poulsen climbed to the seat, and Elsa leaned against the tailgate, looking at the bundled sick men, all of them big, strapping men, and she thought again of the thing people said, that the flu took the strongest first, the ones with the deep chests and wide backs. The tears in her eyes were like pebbles of ice.
"Goodbye," she said. "Get well quick, all of you."
She said it to all, but she looked only at Bo. She saw his jaw relax a little.
"Take it easy, Mama," he said. "I got enough meanness in me to poison any germ."
"John Chapman died this morning,"
Poulsen said from the seat. Bo sat up, and the stab he made to catch his balance with his hand made him grit his teeth.
"What did you say?"
"John Chapman's dead. Funny thing, Doc O'Malley says his heart was all out of place, clear over on the right side. Been that way all his life. Never think it a big, tall guy like that."
Bo's eyes sought Elsa's.
"By Godfrey," he said, "I almost forgot about something."
"Shall I do anything about it?"
She, too, had forgotten that they owed Chapman $200. Now Chapman was dead. But they could pay it back as soon as she delivered those cases.
"No," Bo said. "Let it go. Everything's closed up anyway. Let it go."
He lay back on the hay and stared upward.
"John Chapman,"
he said, as if he didn't believe it.
"I talked to him 3 days ago, and he was as well as I was."
"Bo,"
Elsa said. Poulsen flipped the lines, and the sled started, the runners creaking in the dry snow, breaking down through the drift as he swung around toward the school.
"Goodbye," Elsa shouted. "I'll be up to see you every chance I get. And please be careful. Do what they say."
For just an instant, as the sled slid away, and she saw the schoolhouse 2 blocks beyond in the middle of the white field, the symbol now of plague and death because it housed in its 4 square rooms dozens of sick men and women, Elsa was shaken by utter panic. Then the moment passed, and she turned back to the house. Bo would be better there. The doctor was living there now, and there were nurses on duty day and night. She would have plenty to do trying to keep the boys safe and taking care of Bo's whiskey. For an hour she went about the house cleaning up all the leavings of the 2 men, throwing Bo's clothes in a tub of water and starting them to boil, hanging out all the blankets and quilts that had been over him and Ole, scalding the used dishes with triple doses of boiling water. Then she stood and looked at the stack of sacked whiskey in the corner, the keg on the kitchen chair with its bung up. That next, the sooner the better. Altogether, she made 3 trips, taking 2 cases at a time on Chet's sled, going boldly through the main street because she believed literally Bo's story of the emergency. She knocked on doors and was greeted suspiciously from inside until she told her errand, when the doors came wide and eager hands reached for the ears of the sacks.
"I'll have to have the money right now," she told them stolidly. "Bo's sick, but he told me not to leave anything without the money, because he borrowed the money to get it and has to pay it back right away."
2 of her customers paid at once. 1/3 grumbled about the price. Elsa said, quite honestly, that she knew nothing about that except what Bo had told her. If the price wasn't all right, she would take it back. But Bill Patterson, who was doing the grumbling, didn't want it taken back. He went and found $48 in every denomination down to pennies. At the 4th house, Jewel King wanted the whiskey but didn't have the money. The bank was closed. Chapman was dead. He couldn't pay till he could get into the bank again.
"I'm sorry," Elsa said. "Bo said not to leave it without the money. I can't."
"But good Lord, Elsa," King said, "we need that stuff. If Bo was here, he wouldn't hold out. I'd give you the money in a minute if I could lay hands on it."
If it had been her own doing, she would have let him have it. But she didn't want to do anything that Bo could find fault with. She hated this job, so she would do it impeccably.
"I wish I could, Jewel," she said, "but Bo said not to."
"Well, let me have some of it," Jewel said. "I got enough money for a bottle or two. I got to have something around with all these germs in the air."
"You come down," Elsa said. "Bo tipped over on the way in and broke quite a few, and that left some loose bottles. I'll sell you all you want of those, or there's some bulk in a keg."
"Okay," he said. "I'll come down." "Bo tipped over, you say? How'd he get back up?"
"I don't know. He wouldn't tell me."
King, scratching himself thoughtfully under the arm, laughed.
"Old Bo," he said, "he's quite a boy."
"He brought a homesteader named Ole Peterson in with him," Elsa said. "He had the flu, and now Bo's got it."
King eased his weight onto the other foot. He obviously did not care to continue the conversation. Gregariousness had suddenly ceased to be pleasurable in White Mud.
"Yeah," he said. "Tough. Well..."
So Elsa pulled the case of bourbon back to the house, unloaded it, put the Irish on the sled, and went to the schoolhouse to see Bo. They wouldn't let her in. Visitors were not allowed. The best she could do was wait in the vestibule while Regina O'Rulian went to find O'Malley. When he came, he didn't have the money either.
"If you want to leave it anyway," he said, "I can have a check for you tonight."
For just an instant, looking at his young, tired, sleepless-eyed face, she hesitated.
"Don't leave it if you don't want to," he said. "I can see why you might not. I might die, and you'd never be able to distill it out of me."
"I guess I'll take a chance," she said, and smiled at him.
The doctor ducked out of the storm door and carried in the sack.
"I suppose you want to know how your husband is."
"I'd like to, yes."
"I wouldn't worry," O'Malley said. "He's too ornery to be hurt much. I tried putting packs on his hands and feet, and he about tore the ward down. He'll be all right."
Elsa saw that he didn't like Bo. He didn't like him, and yet he had a sneaking admiration for him. A lot of people reacted to him that way. They saw only his hard side.
"Well, thanks," she said. "Can I come back here every day and find out how he is?"
"Or call up," he said. "That's better."
He looked at her speculatively.
"How many of you at home now?"
"The two boys and I."
"If any of you get it," he said, "call up here right away. I can't do a thing unless I have everybody in one place. And if you hear of anyone else, call me, will you?"
"I will," she said. "And you're sure Bo isn't really very sick?"
"He's sick enough," O'Malley said, "but I think he'll be all right."
On the way back home again through the crusted drifts, she saw the sun break through the mist and shine for a few minutes, thin and watery on the snow. She was glad O'Malley was there instead of old Dr. Barber. She remembered Barber, sag-cheeked, shaking-handed, riddled with dope or whatever it was he took. He must have been pretty far gone to drink denatured alcohol on a bet, the way he did. It occurred to her that everywhere she and Bo had lived there was somebody like Dr. Barber, lost and derelict and painful to see. Were they all over, she wondered, or was it just that Bo took them always to the fringes of civilization, where the misfits and the drifters all congregated? After lunch, there was the problem of keeping the boys in the parlor while she served the continuous stream of people who came, some with milk pails, some with fruit jars, some furtive, some loud. The kitchen was headachy with the barroom smell of rye slopped from the keg. By supper time, she had taken in, from case goods and bulk, $265. At 8 o'clock that night, she bundled up and walked to the schoolhouse, found that Bo was sleeping and doing as well as could be expected, collected the $65 from the doctor, and came home again. She put her afternoon's total of $330, along with the $6 she had got from Polson in the morning, tucking it down in a box at the bottom of her bureau drawer. Tomorrow, if things went right, she would be shut of the whiskey job. She knew the moment she woke that she was sick. Her bones ached, her head throbbed, her throat was inflamed and sore, and her tongue, when she stuck it out in front of the mirror, was coated with gray-green moss. For a minute, desperately, she tried to pretend it wasn't true. She was just tired. She hadn't slept well. She was coming on toward her time, and that always made her feel low and draggy. But she hadn't been up 10 minutes before the staggering weakness in her legs made her sit down. She called for Chet and Bruce, raising her voice painfully over her sore throat, and in a few minutes Chet came racing downstairs.
"Ma," he said, "Brucey's got it. He threw up all over the bed."
"Oh, my Lord," she said.
Driving herself, she stood up and started for the stairs.
"Call Dr. O'Malley," she said. "Tell him Brucey and Mommy have both got it. You'll have to hold the fort alone, son."
"Jeez," Chet said.
For a moment, she thought he was going to run and cling to her legs as Bruce sometimes did, but he stood still, running his tongue around his upper lip.
"I can do it," he said. "I can milk old Red and sell the whiskey and do everything."
"Sell the whiskey?" she said. "You don't know what you're talking about."
Within an hour, she lay in the hay-filled box of Polson's sleigh, with Bruce pinched and delirious against her side. Polson was not driving the sled today, but a young man she did not know. He said his name was Vickers, and he had just got in from the south the night before. Why, he must be a sort of neighbor of ours, out on the farm, she thought. But she was too weak and tired, and Chet was standing beside the sleigh, too consciously brave in his Mackinaw. The devil could have been driving the team, and she wouldn't have paid very much attention. She made Chet promise to call up twice a day and report to the hospital how he was getting along. She asked Vickers to look in once in a while on his trips around. When they pulled away, she couldn't even kiss Chet or hug him, for fear of the death her lips might carry. She could only wave, sitting up weakly with her muttering younger son under the blankets beside her, and say,
"Goodbye, Chet. Goodbye. You're the man of the family now. You've got to hold the fort."
Too weak and hurried to do anything else, she had left the whiskey in plain sight in the kitchen, the bundle of money she carried in a knotted sock in her purse. Chapter 4 Until afternoon, Chet stayed indoors. The silence of the house bothered him, and the thought of what if Mom and Pa and Brucey never came back at all lay big as a sob in his throat. On his back was the burden of being the man of the house, responsible for the fires, the stock, for getting his own meals and keeping the house clean. He accepted those duties solemnly. For a while he was attentive to the fires, as though they were in danger of flickering out every 10 minutes. He made the beds, he got the broom and stirred a dust in parlor and dining room. As he was eating his second bowl of bread and milk for lunch, the young man named Vickers came back and said he needed some beds and bedding, so Chet helped him knock down both double beds and load them on the sleigh. He would sleep on the couch in the parlor. It was warmer there anyway, and it would be pretty nice to undress right by the fire and pop into bed without any cold old floor and stairs. In the kitchen, making a list of things he had taken, Vickers saw the keg, the sacked bottles.
"Your dad doesn't want to sell any of that, does he?" he said.
"Sure," Chet said. "That's what he got it for, to sell for flu medicine."
"What have you got?"
"Rye and bourbon," Chet said promptly. "There isn't much bourbon left, I guess," he rummaged. 5 bottles is all."
"How much?" Vickers said, and reached for his wallet.
$4 a bottle," Chet said.
He caught himself, shot a look at Vickers' face. If he got more than the regular price, they'd have to admit he had held the fort to a fare-thee-well.
"Or is it 4½?" he said. "I forget."
Vickers' face was expressionless.
"Sure it isn't 5. I wouldn't want to cheat you."
Under his eyes, Chet broke and fled into the other room.
"I'll go look," he said. "I think there's a list."
He stood in the front hall a minute before he came back with his face businesslike, and his mind crafty.
$4.50, he said casually. "I thought probably it was."
Vickers counted $22 out of the wallet, dug in his pocket for 50 cents, and picked up the ripped sack. He stood by the door and looked at Chet and laughed.
"What are you going to do with the extra $2.50? he said.
Chet's heart stopped. His face began to burn.
"What $2.50?
"Never mind," Vickers said. "Have you got all you need to eat here?"
"I got crocks of milk,"
Chet said in relief. He grinned at Vickers, and Vickers grinned back. "Ma baked bread the other day, and there's spuds. I can go out and shoot a rabbit if I need some meat."
"Oh," Vickers said. His eyebrows went up. "You're a hunter, are you?"
"I shot rabbits all last fall for Mrs. Rieger," Chet said. He tried to make it sound matter-of-fact. "She lent me the shotgun and shells. She had to have rabbits and prairie chicken and stuff because she's anemic."
"Hmm," Vickers said. "I guess you can take care of yourself. How old are you?"
12.
"That's old enough," said Vickers. "Well, Mervyn, if you need anything, you call the school and I'll see that you get it."
"My name isn't Mervyn, it's Chet."
"Okay," Vickers said. "Don't get careless with the fires."
"What do you think I am?" Chet said in scorn. He raised his hand stiffly to Vickers and went back to his bread and milk, excited and triumphant. That 2.5 would look pretty good. He wondered how Vickers knew he had been euchred. Because he changed the price, probably. Next time he'd know better than that. He took the money out of his pocket and counted it. $22.50 was a lot of dough. He'd show Mom and Pa whether he could hold the fort or not. But holding the fort got tiresome. The house was too empty. Sitting in the parlor with a book, he heard the walls tick and the floors creak as if under stealthy feet. He looked up every 30 seconds. Then he stood up, stretched his arms elaborately, yawned, and walked through the whole house, basement to attic, as if he were just strolling around. But his eyes were sharp, and he stepped back a little as he threw open the doors of closets and bedrooms. He whistled a little between his teeth. Downstairs again, his suspicions laid, but his boredom even greater, he remembered suddenly that he was the boss of the place. He could go where he liked and do what he pleased, as long as the cows got fed and milked and the house was warm. He thought of the 2 traps he had set at muskrat holes under the river bank. The flu had kept him from visiting them. It might be a good idea to take the gun and go out on a little hunt. "Well," he said in the middle of the parlor rug, "I guess I will." For 1.5 hours he prowled the brush with his father's shotgun. Over on the path toward Heathcliff's, he shot a snowshoe rabbit, white and furry and big-footed, and lugged it triumphantly toward home. One of his traps yielded a stiffly frozen muskrat, and the weight of his game made him proud as he came up the dugway, swinging the rabbit by a foot, the muskrat by its plaited tail. Coming past the barn, he looked toward Van Dam's, then the other way toward Chance's, hoping somebody would be out and see him. He whistled loudly, sang a little into the cold afternoon air. But the desertion of the whole street, the unbroken fields of snow, where ordinarily there would be sled tracks and fox and geese paths, let a chill in on his pride. He came up the back steps soberly and opened the unlocked door. The muskrat's slippery tail slid through his mittened hand, and the frozen body thumped on the floor. 2 men were in the kitchen. His chest tight with surprise and shock, Chet looked from one, standing by the whiskey keg, to the other, at the table with a cup before him. One he didn't know, the one at the table was Lewis Treat, a half-breed who hung out at the stable and sometimes worked a little for old man Purcell. All Chet knew of him was that he could braid horsehair ropes and used to sing a lot of dirty songs.
"Aha," Lewis Treat said. He smiled at Chet and made rubbing motions with his hands. "We have stopped to get warm. You have been hunting."
"Yeah," Chet said.
He stood where he was, his eyes swinging to the other man by the keg. The man was looking at Lewis.
"He's nice rabbit there," Lewis said.
His bright black eyes went over the boy. Chet lifted the rabbit and looked at the drops of frozen blood like red beads on the fur.
"Yeah," he said.
He was thinking about what his father said. You could trust an Indian if he was your friend, and you could trust a white man if his pocketbook wasn't involved, and you could trust a Chink more than either, but you couldn't trust a half-breed. He looked at the man by the keg and decided that he looked tough. Lewis's voice went on.
"You have mushrat too, eh? You like me to help you peel these muskrat?"
His hand dipped under his sheepskin and produced a long-bladed knife that snapped open with the pressure of his thumb on a button. Chet stayed where he was.
"No thanks,"
he said. "I can peel him." Lewis shrugged and put the knife